Syrians are celebrating the downfall of the Assad regime, but many still want to see the deposed dictator brought to justice.
For me, I will feel victory and celebrate when I see Assad in the court. And I will do all my best to see this moment.
More about this moment in Syria ahead. I'm Carol Hills. Also today, the largest Indian Sikh community outside South Asia is here in North America.
So if you asked up until very recently the average Sikh in Punjab, you know, where would you like to go anywhere in the world, they would have answered Canada.
So why has that started to change? And we meet a young activist trying to make a difference, but he runs into a bureaucratic wall.
They're not taking me seriously. I'm just a kid.
We've got all those stories and more ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us on this Friday the 13th. Today was a day of celebration in cities across Syria. Thousands of Syrians gathered around the Umayyad Mosque in Damascus for Friday prayers. It was the first time in many years that the mosque was open to anyone. Under the rule of Bashar al-Assad, Syria's capital city was tightly controlled and mostly inaccessible to anyone who dared to openly oppose his government. Since the sudden collapse of the Assad regime 5 days ago, many Syrians have rushed to the infamous Saydnaya prison in Damascus. That's where people were taken by the regime to disappear. The few who were lucky enough to get out alive have described horrific conditions there. The Royal Shirin Jafari has been speaking with families of those who went missing. They've been on a desperate search to find their loved ones.
In the Syrian capital yesterday, the body of Mazen al-Hamada was laid to rest. This marked the final chapter in the life of a man who dared to stand up against the government of Bashar al-Assad. Hamada was a well-known activist. He was arrested and released several times, once for smuggling baby formula to a suburb of Damascus, which was under siege. This week, his body was found at a hospital near Damascus. His niece said it bears signs of torture. Hamada was detained at the Saydnaya prison, the detention facility that has for years been synonymous with death and disappearance.
This is the first time we saw real photos and videos coming out of Saydnaya.
Fadl Abdelghani is the founder of the Syrian Network for Human Rights. For the past decade, his team has been documenting cases of Syrians who were arrested and never heard of again. He says when the Syrian government fell last Sunday, families of those who had vanished into Assad's network of prisons suddenly had a renewed hope.
The families, they slept on the ground.
Some who traveled from other cities slept in the open area outside the prison. They lit small bonfires to keep themselves warm. Meanwhile, the Syrian civil defense, known as the White Helmets, dug for possible underground tunnels and secret prison cells. The White Helmets are a group of first responders who've played a crucial role in rescuing survivors in the aftermath of airstrikes during the Syrian war. Ismail Al-Abdullah is with the group.
After working 24 hours, we didn't discover anything. Nothing.
Al-Abdullah tells me the families kept insisting that they dig.
They don't want to believe that their loved ones and their relatives are gone, killed by the brutal regime.
A few hours later, Fadl Abdelghani of the Syrian Network for Human Rights decided to break the news to the families. Abdelghani broke down as he began to make the announcement he'd never wanted to make. That between 80 and 90,000 people were likely killed under torture or executed.
I wasn't able to hold myself. It's a heavy burden. So many families waiting for any hint of hope.
This number, he explains, is based on years of documentation using civil registry and death certificates. Someone who's been desperately hoping for some good news this week is Samer Dabul.
My uncle was my favorite person. He was so kind person.
Dabul was in high school in 2012 when his uncle, Abdul Rahman Abdul Razak, was taken from his home in Aleppo. The city had become too dangerous. So on a hot summer day, the whole family packed into their cars and drove to Idlib, a city further north. Abdul Razak told Dabul that he had to return to Aleppo to pick up some books he had left behind. He taught Arabic at the university there and treasured his books, Dabul says. He remembers their last conversation.
He say, when I will back, we will go to drink matte. And the matte, it's a famous drink in Syria. I don't know if you know it.
He never returned. His wife, who was with him, said that government security forces came to their home and took him away. This week, when he heard about the release of prisoners, he felt hopeful. He lives in Europe, so he couldn't go to the prison in person. He pored over WhatsApp groups and searched lists of prisoners that were making the rounds online.
I saw today my uncle's name on one of the list.
It was in a WhatsApp group chat, he says, and he's sure it's him because all the details match.
The birthday, the mother's name, the father's name.
Even though the White Helmets have called off the search at Sednaya prison and the Syrian Network for Human Rights declared any missing person is likely dead, Dabul says he's determined to find his uncle. He says his family deserves closure and his fight against the man responsible for all of this will continue.
For me, I will feel victory and celebrate when I see Assad in the court. And I will do all my best to see this moment.
No one who orders such crimes should be walking free, Dabul says. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Some mornings are tough, and it seems like the only thing propelling you to get up and get started with your day is coffee. Well, brace yourself. Coffee prices are going up. Peter Roberts is the Academic Director of Specialty Coffee Programs at the Business and Society Institute at Emory University.
On the low end of retail markets for about a decade, it's a very, very boring, flat, upward sloping line. Prices increase by about 2% a year. Recently, we've got some green price movement that's getting people all excited.
When you say green coffee, that's the color of the bean. So that's before it's turned into coffee that we drink.
That's right. So if you're sort of standing kind of on a coffee farm or processing facility in Central America, it's the stuff that gets loaded onto containers. And then, you know, after it kind of goes across the ocean, gets pulled out, gets roasted. And that's what we see when we buy beans at coffee shops.
Who do green coffee producers sell most of their beans to?
Instant coffee, gas station coffee, the bottom shelf of your grocery store, the folks that are still functional, you know, with their coffee. The kind of coffee that most of us like kind of in the morning, the Arabica. Arabica coffee is a little bit fickle, a lot more challenging for farmers to produce, reliably produce volumes of Arabica coffee at the qualities that we like.
Why is that?
Just because it's a very precious plant. It was sort of meant to grow in forests in Ethiopia and Yemen. It was moved to places that had just the right kind of climate conditions, and it likes to grow in that. But if it gets a little bit too cold or a little bit too volatile or a little bit too dry, then coffee doesn't like it.
So what's causing this rise in green coffee or the commodity price for coffee?
I've got to say, you know, I look at it when I teach my students about this. There are a lot of things that go on behind the scenes. Climate change is one of them. But there's an awful lot of things that relate to sort of speculation, big hedge fund investors. There's a lot of things that cause gyrations in commodity markets. And what happens in a moment like this, it's comfortable to say that the world is reacting to the sort of things that relate to climate change. But I think it's important to note that I'm just looking at numbers here that between June 2022 and September 2023, the green commodity price fell. And if you're going to say that climate change is responsible for the rise in the last year, then you kind of have to have this weird notion that says we didn't care about climate change between 2022 and 23. So there's a lot going on. And I just think it's really, really convenient in the context of rising prices to look and say, oh, you know, markets do a good job responding to climate change because they don't. I've had a couple of, you know, recent conversations with folks from the Wall Street Journal that were kind of the same thing is, you know, what's the relationship between retail prices and commodity prices? And really there isn't one. And they say, well, how is that so? I said, those are interesting questions, but people buy green coffee on a certain set of terms and they sell roasted coffee on a different set of terms, and they just don't come together.
So let's talk about those commodity trading houses for green coffee. Are you saying that some of the price rise could be from speculative investments?
Not even could, and not even some. The year to year, or if you look at 10-year trend lines over time, commodity coffee's prices are declining, you know, over time. So we don't see this sort of structural rise in prices over time that would be consistent with a growing concern for climate change. What we see is increasing volatility over time, because it's a lot more interesting if you're a trader to trade off moment-to-moment movements in prices. And when you basically have hedge fund activities and massive speculation done off of margin investing, you're going to get wild price swings day to day, month to month, year to year.
Bottom line, do you think we are seeing misleading headlines about coffee prices going up?
Yeah, I do. I do think we're going to see rising prices. I don't think they're related to climate change, right? Because again, the climate change affects the growers. It's quite a roller coaster if you look at the graph over time. And we have this sort of a very dramatic increase nominally in green coffee prices in the last year. And so that sort of creates an opportunity for folks that are kind of selling off of those green coffees to have a look at what retail prices are doing. You know, the growers' situation is too volatile for this to be attributed to a sort of a structural increase that relates to climate change.
Peter Roberts is the Academic Director of Specialty Coffee Programs at Emory University. This music video has been played nearly a million times since Wednesday. Here's what viewers see. It's nighttime. The musicians have improvised an outdoor concert stage. They've unrolled a huge Persian carpet in front of a centuries-old brick building. In the past, this would have been a resting place for travelers. But on this night, we see a four-piece band. Piano, guitar, bass, and drums. And a singer. They're all dressed in black. The singer is Parastu Ahmadi, and there's been a lot of attention paid to what this Iranian performer is wearing, a floor-length black gown with spaghetti straps baring her shoulders. In the West, it might seem a conservative choice. For Iran's religious leaders, it's over the line.
Merci.
As the first song ends, there is no applause. There's no audience. We do not know when this 27-minute concert was videotaped, but we know that when Parastu streamed it on her YouTube channel Wednesday night, the response was electric. Tens of thousands of people viewed it in the first few hours, and almost on cue, the next morning, Iranian authorities had opened a case against the singer and her production team, accusing them of putting on an illegal concert. Parastu includes a note at the beginning of the video. It reads, "I am Parastu, a girl who wants to sing for the people I love. This is a right I could not refuse, singing for the land I love with all my heart." The seven-song set includes well-known classics by Persian composers and poets. Parastu ends the concert with a revolutionary poem that's landed her in trouble with authorities before. She performed this song, "Tulips Rise from the Blood of the Nation's Youth," during nationwide anti-headscarf protests in 2022. It was written more than a century ago as a patriotic commemoration of Iran's first modern constitution. The lyrics urge the listener to take a stand, to expose corruption and injustice. Following that performance in 2022, Parastu was summoned by security officials and her home was searched. What the authorities will do this time is not clear. 27-year-old Parastu Ahmadi has a degree in filmmaking, and she understands symbolism. Performing with a group of male musicians, appearing without a headscarf, she must have known this would bring a response. But Parastu clearly loves her country. Around her neck, she wears a small pendant in the shape of the map of Iran. And as anyone can see if they look carefully, she wears it close to her heart.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Matthew Bell, an editor and reporter for The World. I work closely with our hosts and correspondents based around the globe to bring you stories that matter. Recently, I reported on the surprise move by South Korea's president, Yoon Suk-yeol, to declare martial law and suspend the legislature in Seoul. This was one of those day of breaking news stories that required some real hustle from us here in the Boston newsroom. But this story is not over, and I'm currently planning a trip to South Korea to do more in-depth reporting about what's at stake in this political moment for the people of that country. This sort of journalism takes time and effort and, of course, money. At The World, we're committed to delivering nuanced journalism that puts real people at the center of every story. But as an independent, nonprofit newsroom, we can't do it without you. Your support, especially recurring gifts, makes our journalism possible. It gives us the time to ask tough questions, tackle hard issues, and plan future coverage that keeps you informed and engaged. Right now, your gift can have double the impact. If you value journalism that dives deeper, shines a light on critical global issues, and gives you context you can trust, please donate before December 31st. Visit theworld.org/give to make your gift today. That's theworld.org/give. And thanks so much.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. For decades, members of the Sikh faith in the northern Indian state of Punjab have been pushing for their own independent state called Khalistan. During the 1970s and 80s, the movement reached its peak in an armed insurgency that killed thousands of people. It was largely put down in 1984 when the Indian military killed hundreds of Sikhs at the Golden Temple, one of the holiest sites in the Sikh faith. Afterward, Prime Minister Indira Gandhi was assassinated by a Sikh guard, and the Indian government outlawed the pro-Khalistan movement. In recent decades, huge numbers of Sikhs have left India and resettled in Canada, a country they've seen as a safer place to live. But that might be changing, as The World's Bianca Hillier reports from Toronto.
Nimakh, nimakh, tum hai.
The Ontario Khalsa Darbar is one of the biggest gurdwaras in North America. Hundreds, if not thousands, of people visit daily. Balpreet Singh says for members of the Sikh community, like himself, it's far more than a place of worship.
This is where you come to network, where you come to talk about recent events, where you come to organize, where you come to find somewhere to rent a space because there's, like, you know, ads on the wall. So this is really a community center for the Sikh community.
Singh, who is the legal counsel for the World Sikh Organization, takes me on a tour of the gurdwara, and we stop at the main hall. In the center of the room sits an elaborate throne. It's draped in gold cloth and houses a thick text.
Guru Granth Sahib is our scripture, and, you know, right now someone is reading from Guru Granth Sahib, and at other times someone will be singing hymns from the Guru Granth Sahib.
We then walk to the kitchen and eating area called a langar. People eat off metal lunch trays while sitting cross-legged on long red rugs, which are spread in rows on the floor.
What this signifies is that everyone's equal. In India anyways, and even still today, people are divided in castes. That sets people apart based on how they were born and what family they were born. The idea of a langar is that everyone is the same, and we reject caste as a faith. And sometimes when you can sit together and just have a meal and just have a chat, it breaks down barriers.
Singh says when he was growing up, outside of Toronto, there were no gurdwaras in his town.
I never saw any Sikhs, and now we have a gurdwara 10 minutes away from where I live. We're seeing Sikh communities coming up in places where we never would have imagined.
He says that's because Canada has been seen as a home away from home for their community.
So if you asked, up until very recently, the average Sikh in Punjab, you know, where would you like to go anywhere in the world, they would have answered Canada.
They would have answered Canada. Now, for some people, it's less clear. Singh says the safe space is under threat because of what's been happening in recent years.
Hundreds of community members and supporters of the Khalistan movement came together, all to commemorate the life of Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
In June of 2023, prominent Sikh activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar was killed at his gurdwara just outside of Vancouver. His death escalated decades-long tensions between Canada and India. The rift deepened a couple of months later when Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau accused the Indian government of being behind Nijjar's death, which he called an assassination.
Any involvement of a foreign government in the killing of a Canadian citizen on Canadian soil is an unacceptable violation of our sovereignty. In the strongest possible terms, I continue to urge the government of India to cooperate with Canada to get to the bottom of this matter.
India's government strongly denies any involvement in Nijjar's death and says Canada has not shared a shred of evidence backing its allegations. The country's High Commission in Canada declined to comment for this story, but in a statement this October, India's government said, quote, "There is a deliberate strategy of smearing India for political gains." In Canada, Sikh activist Gurjop Singh Brar wants the pressure on India to continue.
At what point do we draw the line and say, you know what? We can't stand by this nation in any capacity. The pushback that has occurred is a good first step. It can't be seen as the end-all be-all.
Brar attends university outside of Toronto and is acutely aware of the dangers of being an outspoken Sikh. His family members were killed by the Indian military at the Golden Temple attack in 1984, and his father recently received what's called a duty to warn from the Canadian government.
The police are coming to the house and saying, look, your life is in danger, just letting you know, but we can't do anything about it.
As startling as that may be, Brar says it's not surprising.
At a certain point, it becomes the norm. Like, my dad has threats against his life. My grandfather had multiple attempts against his life. My great-grandfather was killed. When you have an oppressive regime that's trying to kill you and kill your people, the loudest voice is going to be the one that gets silenced first. And that's not something that we really shy away from.
Young people like Brar are the fastest growing age group among Sikhs in Canada. That has largely been fueled by a steady stream of international students. Brar says among the young Sikhs in his circle, conversations around the independent state of Khalistan remain robust.
We have people that come in that are completely anti-Khalistan. We have people that come in that are completely pro-Khalistan. We have people that come in with a map already formed and they have a picture of it and say, this is what the map is going to look like. We have people come in who say, well, maybe we should figure out a system within India. But the commonality is we need to figure out what works for our community and what works to get that foot off our neck.
40 years after the attack at the Golden Temple, at least one member of Canada's parliament is working to advance the interests of Sikhs in the country. Last week, Sukh Dhaliwal spoke in the House of Commons.
I rise today to address the Sikh genocide. There have been consultations among the parties, and I believe you will find unanimous consent for the following motion, that the House acknowledge and recognize that the crimes committed against Sikhs within India in 1984 constitute a genocide.
I'm already hearing a number of no's.
Dhaliwal's motion for Canada to recognize the 1984 attack in India as genocide was swiftly denied. Chandra Arya was one of the parliamentarians who objected, which he explained in a video posted on social media.
The 1984 anti-Sikh riots in India were undeniably barbaric. However, labeling these tragic and dreadful riots as a genocide is misleading and unjustified. Such an assertion risks driving a wedge between Hindu and Sikh communities in Canada.
There is a rising concern about a wedge between Hindus and Sikhs.
Police have made another arrest after violent protests between Hindu and Sikh groups in Brampton. They responded.
Violence broke out last month outside a Hindu temple in the Toronto area, where Sikhs were protesting a visit by Indian consular officials. Canada's Hindu Federation condemned the incident and said places of worship should remain free from violence or disturbance. Gurjop Singh Brar says Sikhs have never had any problem with the Hindu community and says the violence last month wasn't based on religious grounds.
We see this as the Indian government finding a key group of fanatics and sending them to do their dirty work. Because Sikhs will never blame a religious group or a religious community for the actions of people. To me, those were just stooges of the Indian government.
As tensions simmer, relations between Canada and India remain at an impasse. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier, Toronto.
In Ukraine, it's Russia who suffered far more casualties on the battlefield, but the Ukrainians have lost a lot of troops too, and that's becoming a real problem.
Wars are won and lost by people on the ground, and especially when it comes to infantry, Ukraine does not have enough of them due to deliberate choices that it's made.
The debate in Ukraine about lowering the draft age, that's ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. You may not be aware of this, but we have a lot in common with Neanderthals. That's in part because around 47,000 years ago, humans and Neanderthals started interbreeding. That's according to a pair of new studies looking at the origins of humanity. The interbreeding between humans and Neanderthals has left genetic fingerprints in modern-day people, like you and me. Chris Stringer is an expert on human evolution and a professor at the Natural History Museum in the UK.
What's interesting is that looking at the DNA from some quite old Homo sapiens fossils from Europe that are about 45,000 years old, they've been able to show that the interbreeding they have from Neanderthals had arrived quite recently, as you say, 47 or 48,000 years ago. And that's much more recent than most of us thought. The general view was that the interbreeding happened more than 50,000 years ago, between 50 and 60,000. But this interbreeding event is much more recent, and it's significant because it's the same interbreeding event in those ancient fossils as we have today. So there's essentially one main interbreeding event, and that is then taken around the world, and that also puts a cap on the age of that, you know, that spread of Homo sapiens today to regions like China and Australia and Western Europe.
From an evolutionary point of view, how different were Neanderthals with the early humans they encountered and interbreeded with? Were they an entirely different species?
Well, there are different views on that, of course. And I think they were a different species because in their anatomy, the Neanderthals are very distinct from us. They have a different shaped skull. They have a different shaped skeleton. And of course, we know their DNA is distinct. So yes, I regard them as a different species. And we separated more than 500,000 years ago. Some people put it, including me, closer to 1 million years ago. So quite a deep separation. And in that time, largely they went their separate ways. We evolved in Africa. The Neanderthals evolved in Europe and Asia. Now and again, they did come into contact. So we know Homo sapiens made a few earlier exits from Africa, and it looks like there was a little bit of interbreeding in those earlier times. But the interbreeding event that we find today in our genomes was this later event around 47 or 48,000 years ago. The earlier interbreeding events of traces of those has largely disappeared.
And why is the earlier interbreeding event 47,000 years ago so important to our understanding of human evolution?
Well, because it is the event that we find in people outside of Africa all around the world. So essentially the same interbreeding event, the traces of what are found in people in Europe, people in China, the Native Americans, Native Australians, and so on. So we all have that single interbreeding event, and it suggests that essentially there was probably a single ancestral Homo sapiens population around 48,000 years ago, probably living in the Middle East. And there they met Neanderthals and interbred with them. And then they started to spread out in different directions. And so that's a single event, which is later in time than we thought. And that puts a maximum age to the arrival in places like Australia of the ancestors of today's Native Australians. They can't be on this basis really any older than about 48,000 years in terms of their ancestry.
So what are the genetic markers that survived and continue on today?
So there seem to be four areas where there was an accentuation of the Neanderthal DNA, where it became quite rapidly more frequent, and that comes through to the present day. And one of those is to do with immune systems. When our ancestors came out of Africa into Europe and Asia, they were encountering new environments, new pathologies, new diseases, new pathogens, new parasites. The Neanderthals, having evolved there for hundreds of thousands of years, had developed natural immunities to many of those. And so by interbreeding with them, we picked up some of their immune systems and got a quick fix to our immune systems. Similarly, in our physiology, so some bits of our biology are influenced by Neanderthal DNA. For example, if you're a morning person rather than an evening person, that could be due to your Neanderthal DNA. If your blood clotting is a bit faster than normal, that could be down to your Neanderthal DNA. The people who came out of Africa were really quite dark-skinned, dark-haired, dark-eyed. We picked up some genes from Neanderthals which led to slightly lighter skin colour, and that would have been advantageous in lower sunlight to be able to make vitamin D in our skins. And there are some bits of DNA which today are associated with things like autism. And strangely, those also seem to have become more common as part of our Neanderthal inheritance.
Chris Stringer is an expert on human evolution and a professor at the Natural History Museum in the United Kingdom. Early this morning, Russia launched one of its biggest attacks ever against Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Russia fired more than 90 missiles and 200 drones. The Russian military is also making gains on the front lines, and that's forced Ukraine to figure out ways to increase the number of recruits. But Ukraine's leadership has been unwilling to draft younger men between the ages of 18 and 25. That's despite coming under pressure from Ukraine's partners, as the world's Daniel Hoffman reports.
In Ukraine, men of military age need to register for the draft, and they're prohibited from leaving the country. However, the government has resisted drafting men who are under the age of 25, a choice that many of Ukraine's allies have criticized. Last week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken commented on this issue during a visit to NATO headquarters in Brussels.
Even with the money, even with the munitions, there have to be people on the front lines to deal with the Russian aggression. Ukraine has hard decisions to make about further mobilization, but these are necessary decisions.
Last month, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed his position on mobilization during an interview with Sky News. He spoke through an interpreter.
Frankly, we must save as many lives as possible. And if in European or American offices there is an idea that we need to do something differently about the draft age, I want to just ask our partners to do their part of the job, and we will deal with our part of the job.
Zelensky and many in Ukraine have on one hand been thankful for Western military support, but on the other have questioned their full commitment. Olena Tregub is the executive director of the Kyiv-based Independent Anti-Corruption Commission. She says many Ukrainians believe that the military support has been too slow. They say the Western equipment takes too long to reach the front lines.
This, of course, affects their recruitment because we cannot mobilize our young men who are 18 or 25, and we just equip them with rifles and send them to fight Russia because they will just die.
Tregub says that the longevity of the war and its psychological impact has slowed down recruitment. She says Ukraine is mobilizing about 15 to 20,000 new troops each month, which is less than in the early days of the full-scale war. And as the war goes on, the fighting force becomes less professional.
Professional military in Ukraine, people who had experience fighting things 2014, many of them are dead or wounded. And unfortunately, many people don't even survive a year on the front line just because how brutal the war is.
Tregub also points to corruption in the mobilization process. She says there have been cases of people paying bribes to not get drafted, which has led to an uproar in Ukrainian society.
They say that people who are rich, they can try avoid mobilization, and people who don't have money, they go to war. And this is not fair.
Tregub says all these issues have a chilling effect on mobilization. She acknowledges that Ukraine needs to fill its ranks, but she says that most Ukrainians don't believe that expanding the draft to younger people will solve the problem.
Wars are won and lost by people on the ground. And especially when it comes to infantry, Ukraine does not have enough of them due to deliberate choices that it's made.
This is Ryan Evans, the founder of War on the Rocks, a media outlet on strategy, defense, and foreign affairs.
And the evidence is on the battlefield. What we see on the Ukrainian side are units that are often median age in their 40s, and their losses aren't being replaced fast enough. And these units are not being rotated out enough to rest after some very intense combat operations.
In April, Ukraine lowered the mobilization age for combat duty from 27 to 25. There are people in Ukraine who support lowering it further to 20 or 21, but Evan says that this kind of incremental approach won't solve the problem.
There's a reason why the average age of Marine infantry units is in the very early 20s, the most elite infantry force in the world. Infantry is best fought and most effectively fought by young people because it is so intensely and physically demanding. And Ukraine doesn't have that population mobilized at its front in any significant numbers.
Oleksandra Koidel, a professor at the Kyiv School of Economics, says that one of the main reasons why drafting younger people has been so politically unpopular has to do with demographics.
Due to historically low birth rates in Ukraine, the generation that was born around 2001, so the current 18, 24 years old, more or less, is really the smallest generation group of men in Ukraine.
Koidel explains that in part, this is the result of the economic crisis and the uncertainty that followed in the decade after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And since this cohort of men is relatively small, Ukrainians are worried about sending them to the front lines in large numbers.
There is no way Ukraine can win a positionality war that uses a lot of manpower against Russia. So Russia has 140 million people. Ukraine has under its current control about 31 million people.
Koidel says that instead of focusing on numbers, Ukraine needs new technology, quality equipment, and creative strategy in order to gain an edge in this war. Many Ukrainians hope that the incoming Trump administration won't follow through on suggestions that they'll slow down shipments of weapons. Until then, Ukrainians hope that they could get as much military aid as possible to stabilize the front line. For The World, I'm Daniel Offman.
The national anthem of Kyrgyzstan is due for an update. That's according to the country's president, Sadir Japarov, who said in a statement, "We need a new anthem that embodies our rich history and the strong nation we are becoming." The old anthem was adopted in 1992, the year after Kyrgyzstan declared independence from the former Soviet Union. The first line of the chorus goes, "March on, O Kyrgyz folk, march towards democracy." A parliamentary commission has now been formed to look for a new anthem, aiming to do so by April 2025. The move follows President Japarov's initiative last year to update the national flag of Kyrgyzstan. Critics say changing the national anthem is an unnecessary distraction from the country's more pressing economic and social issues. Defending the move, Japarov said, "Our history is rich, and we must honor it through our symbols." If you're unfamiliar with the science around mirror life, well, welcome to the club. But this somewhat obscure field of research is coming under new scrutiny because a new study co-authored by a leading group of scientists, Nobel laureates among them, says that mirror microbes could actually be an existential threat to life on Earth. Earlier today, I spoke with one of the co-authors. Von Cooper is an evolutionary microbiologist at the University of Pittsburgh. He started by explaining what mirror life is.
Mirror life is really any form of life, and what we really envision would be initially a bacterium that would be synthesized from scratch, but with all of its molecules in reverse. So it literally would be the mirror image of that organism that lives on the planet.
So the idea is if you create a synthetic mirror image of a molecule or bacteria, that can potentially create useful things in science?
Absolutely. There's some very exciting applications for mirror molecules. The main one is that they would be really long-lived. So for instance, a mirror protein would not be degraded by the enzymes that typically break down proteins. And so that mirror protein would be really durable. So this is a promising area for drug development, among other things.
So that's the potential. That's the excitement. But in this case, there's some serious downsides, and your paper is kind of a warning. So tell us about that.
This area of research has been growing, and now it's at least theoretically feasible to potentially build an entire organism from scratch using mirror molecules. And I really want to emphasize this is at least 10, maybe even 30 or more years away. But if carried to its end, our group believes that that mirror microbe would be largely invisible to all forms of life because life has evolved to interact with one side of the mirror. This would be the opposite, and so it would really be unseen, and that would thus escape all immunity. It would not have any natural predators. The viruses that typically kill most bacteria every day would not work, and so it would just grow exponentially.
Take us into the world of sci-fi. What is the worst-case scenario if mirror life ever came to life?
The worst-case scenario is that this microbe would be able to invade and degrade every ecosystem on Earth, including us. It would invade plants, it would invade animals, it would ultimately be fatal in most interactions.
And we'd all die.
We'd all die.
So regardless of any kind of mirror microbe you built and constructed fully synthetically, there are these inherent dangers. And so it is simply an area that scientists should not embark upon.
That's right. We think that the risks simply do not justify the potential rewards of sort of the what-if discovery and exploration of how life might have walked an alternative path.
Now, just for the sake of argument, who are the stakeholders who might be interested in pursuing mirror molecule technology and might be hard to persuade?
Here's where I really want to draw attention to the several authors on our group who are those stakeholders who were actually doing work moving towards, you know, the long-term goal of synthesizing mirror microbes, who now, recognizing these risks, have become authors of the study and quite vocal advocates for these conversations. And then it's hard to establish these rules and governances without governments and policymakers. And we look forward to some of those conversations and a series of events that we'll be convening in the coming year.
And of course, the public. All of us have to kind of get this and understand it.
100%. And on that note, I don't want to end this on sort of gloom and doom. I think it's really important to recognize, certainly for young scientists, that this is a fascinating idea. This is what science is for. It's sort of to dream what-if scenarios and envision how the world works and how it might work alternatively. And there are important lessons here. If you get a big group of researchers together confronted with a problem like this, we can work together pretty effectively to come up with, in this case, a 300-page, really detailed report about various aspects of this problem.
Vaughn Cooper is an evolutionary microbiologist at the University of Pittsburgh. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Coming right up, we're going to hear how a proverb from India helped a kid in the U.S. bringing about change in his own community. The story begins in the early days of COVID-19 lockdowns. Back then, Amrit Salagrama was living in Massachusetts. His grandfather, or Tata, was visiting from India, as he often did, for months at a time. There wasn't much for them to do. Businesses were closed, school was canceled, and people didn't feel safe getting together. Here's Amrit Salagrama explaining what the two of them did instead. It's from the GBH television series, Stories from the Stage.
Tata and I resorted to taking long walks together to pass the time. I love him very much, and as the youngest grandson, I felt a very close and special relationship with him as we walked through the neighborhood together. And while walking, we discussed proverbs in Kannada, which is our mother tongue. But after some time, he decided to stop going on walks with me, and I finally worked up the courage to ask him, Tata, what's wrong? I thought you loved going on walks with me. And he puts down his newspaper and hesitates. I still do. It's just that when you're outside, where do you go and you gotta go? I really wanted to solve his problem. I wanted to try and see if I could find a walking path with bathrooms on it so he'd feel comfortable so we could resume the walks. But searching online for public bathrooms near me yielded incomplete or outdated answers. Sometimes, you know, you would get listings of bathrooms that ended up not even existing anymore, and you would get other ones that were from a private business, which we weren't allowed to use. So I then was kind of stumped. I didn't really know where to proceed. I knew I could count on maybe a town hall or a public library, but past that, I was really unsure, and I was thinking maybe a public park would have a porta potty, or, you know, a public building might allow people to go in. So I was looking up, you know, listings of public buildings in the towns near me and public parks, and at the bottom of every page there was a contact us link. So I decided that I might just email them, and I inserted a lot of apologies of wasting their time with my stupid little request that, you know, I was just trying to find a walking trail for my grandfather, but I needed a list of bathrooms so that I would know where to map it out. I hacked away at these emails for different municipalities, but only a few days later, I got one email back thanking me for my effort, but they didn't have a list of bathrooms. And up until this point, I don't think that I'd ever understood how to solve a problem on my own, because as the youngest, I always had my older brother or my parents or my grandparents to ask, and they would either have paved the road ahead for me, shown me steps on how to solve a problem, or would have solved the problem for me. But here was my grandfather asking me this question. And growing up in the internet age, you could always search online for these sorts of things, but Google was failing me in this case. I didn't really know what to do here. And I finally had the realization that my grandfather wasn't the only person suffering from these issues. Of course, other elderly people would have his condition, and there would be people who have different conditions. And there are parents with toddlers who would need to find restrooms. And especially there would be people whose jobs took them out and about, like taxi drivers or delivery drivers. And so these people must know where to find restrooms, right? And I decided to poll social media. I decided to ask the neighborhood's Facebook, the subreddits for taxi drivers and delivery drivers. And I asked them, where do you find bathrooms when you're out and about? Where do you go when you gotta go? Echoing my grandfather's plea. And over 200 stomach-churning responses flooded in. I read about taxi drivers having to relieve themselves in wide-mouth bottles in their cars. And I read about racial minorities who are arrested for trying to use retail restrooms. I finally realized that this wasn't just about bathrooms, but about human dignity and fairness. And I realized how I'd been blissfully unaware while Tata was silently struggling and my community was failing its most vulnerable. I then emailed the city officials again, hoping that I could naively convince them that public bathrooms were a problem and that they needed to be listed and they needed to build more of them. But I was met with benign skepticism and assertions that existing facilities were already sufficient. And more often than not, I was met with, "We do not have a list, stop emailing us." I started complaining to my tata. I video called him and I almost cried. I was saying, "They're not taking me seriously. I'm just a kid." But he was never one to tolerate self-pity, and he offered a proverb: "Learn how to count to comprehend the world," he said. And inspired, I decided to gather more concrete data to make my case. I decided to, instead of pestering city officials to give me a list that they clearly didn't have, instead to go to each listing and call just about one public park or one public building. Does that specific one have a restroom? I called 311 numbers, police stations, fire stations, town halls, public libraries to get their bathroom availability, wheelchair accessibility, stall counts, just to make sure that they had a bathroom and all of its information. And my painstakingly curated online map grew to over 400 restrooms, and it's become a key resource for residents and visitors alike. And my work even got awarded by Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, and it was mentioned in many news stories. And to this, I called Tata again, and I was ecstatic. I was bouncing. I said, Tata, they mentioned my work on NBC Boston. Somerville is building 3 new restrooms. How did they manage that? She asked. Well, I did what you told me, I said. Learn how to count to comprehend. And he beamed. He said, actually, the full proverb ends with, as you can't change what you can't comprehend. And as usual, he was right. I've come to understand that convincing people that public bathrooms are important is the easy part, but navigating bureaucracy to influence change is much, much harder. I'll keep trying, even though there are no easy buttons, to make sure that one day Massachusetts leads the U.S. in helping people relieve themselves with dignity. But for now, I can't wait until Tata visits next year. I picture us teasing apart his favorite path in Somerville, which is now restroom accessible. Thank you.
Amra Selagrama told that story in front of a live audience for World TV's Stories from the Stage. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. From PR.